is dialogue. Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News. Saturday at 4, our continuing dialogue with May Bressel, political research specialist. Dialogue, assassination. Well, this week, May, we said we would talk about James Earl Ray and the Martin Luther King assassination, but there were one or two items that have come up in the press in the past week that you wanted to touch on first. Am I correct in that?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the Movie Review and Life magazine of a new picture by Vittorio De Sica called The Garden of the Finzi Cantinas. Have you heard of that movie yet?
No, I haven't.
People in San Francisco and from New York have told me about it. I'm very anxious to see it. And the review written in Life magazine this week reminded me so much of the type of research that I'm doing and what I'm trying to tell the people as depicted in this particular movie. And the movie is about an Italian family who were Jewish, who had a very beautiful garden, and their home was a showplace in Italy. And it's the story of fascism coming around them and encircling their community, and the Jewish families are not able to partake in the community in Italy because of the fascism coming down. So they invite the other people into their garden to share their very beautiful garden. And then eventually Mussolini takes over, and the movie ends with the families all being taken off to the concentration camp. And Life magazine says that Vittorio De Sica is saying that it is a powerful human inclination to ignore unpleasant realities in favor of tending our own private gardens without interruption. And the garden offers its guests a false sense of security. The same harsh aspects of life that give them access to these pleasures within the garden is simultaneously making them more unhappy on the outside. I think of that now because so many people are into organic gardening, communes, doing their own things. I was up at Davis this week where you see a bunch of students throwing their frisbees and bicycle riding and not caring at all about political assassinations and more into their own tending their gardens, their individual organic or communal gardens. And the thing that has made them turn inside to pulling that rake and hoe and pulling into this small enclave is that things outside are so bad. The assassinations, the riots, the drug problems, the chaos in our country is they get bad vibes everywhere, and they're turning into nature to their garden, but the outside is still taking place. And they don't want to be shaken into that outside world, and they're pulling farther back into the garden and the organic thing. And the review of this movie tells how the family is taken away to concentration camps, and they're completely numb that they are the victims of this fascism, and it was impossible for them to believe it. They said the pains that are close to us, the immediate things we can see, we can handle. If they knock on the door and hurt one person, we can see that. Or if somebody's taken off to jail, you can see that. But while they're in the garden, they try to avoid dealing with those things that are faceless institutional madness that affects their lives. They couldn't handle that facelessness, and eventually they all died anyway.
That was one of the factors involved. I just finished reading The 12 Years Reich, and he did sort of a summary to try to figure out how did it happen in Nazi Germany, and that was one of the things, of course, complacency. And another thing that he mentioned, another very important factor, was little by little, the masses willingly gave up their political liberties for economic security. And as long as you could keep them happy in their possessions, or as J. Edgar Hoover frequently does with his crime statistics, tell them their possessions are being threatened.
They'll fight to hold on.
And we'll take care of you if you'll just give us more power. Oh, yeah, take more power. More policemen, more power, more laws. And the next thing they know, those laws are coming down on them.
Well, you see, I, after the political assassination of John Kennedy, and I began to research who was into that, and tried to tell the youth people, the music people, you know, it'll affect your rock concerts, your pops, your music culture. They withdrew into a music thing, which is a political substitute or protest in a way.
You don't have that to withdraw into anymore.
And that doesn't exist anymore. That has been taken over. And the gardening thing that's involved, the movie now is about gardening, and the organic gardeners are tilling their soil, and they think the outside isn't going to touch them, but it will. Now we'll get right on.
That's what the hermits up in Coldwater Canyon thought, too, and I remember sitting in Los Angeles watching in full-color television, wondering why the whole city didn't rise up in outrage when they went up and drug those people out of the woods, tied together on a rope like an Arab slave train, and it showed them leading them down out of the hills, and the only they weren't charged with anything. As a matter of fact, it was just that the rationale for it was, well, a lot of them were smoking up there, and they were a fire hazard.
A fire hazard, and they took them away like animals, like beasts.
Yeah.
Well, you can't escape. You can't escape the political system, and tending a beautiful garden isn't going to do it. That has to be done. That's something different, but that isn't going to solve the problem on the outside. We have to face that hidden government that people don't want to face. They resist what I am saying. Many people, some are beginning to understand, but because it's faceless, it's only faceless because we allow it to be. The people have names and faces and banks and meeting places, and we'll talk about James Ray, because talk about faceless governments. On the birthday of Martin Luther King this year in January, they had celebrations around the country in honor of his birthday, and the Monterey, the San Jose Mercury had an article about Martin Luther King's birthday, that Mrs. King wanted to be a national holiday. And then it goes on to say King was shot and killed by a sniper April 4th, 1968. They don't even bother to say who killed him anymore, just by a sniper, as if they don't even know.
Well, they don't know.
Well, they're keeping the name out of the news because he's been promised parole in 13 years and maybe earlier on good behavior.
So, I'd like to preface this with a remark of my own. I hear an awful lot, you know, why do you talk about stuff like this? It just brings people down. It's such a downer. It's such a drag, you know, and it puts bad vibes in the air and all that. Well, if you were suffering from cancer and didn't know it, and it was curable, I think you would appreciate it if a doctor came along and called your attention to the fact, hey, you've got cancer, let's do something about it. Or, hey, you've got gangrene in that leg, let's take care of it now before the leg falls off, or leprosy or what have you. And this is the kind of thing that Mae Brussel is trying to do, is to awaken you to the fact that there is a cancer here, that it's controlling us.
And it's very hard to get to the people. I asked Monterey Library to carry the magazine Computer and Automation, because since May 1970, they've had articles on the political assassination of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. And I got a letter back from them this February saying that they regret that the book selection committee will not purchase at this time. What I think I will do, I'm going to be over at the library next week. I'm going to buy a subscription for them.
And donate it to the library.
And donate it to the library. I just sent a subscription to Margaret Oswald. She didn't have the issues. And so if I buy the back issue since May and it's free, they certainly can't object to a trade magazine on computer and automation.
Well, this magazine, I think, particularly takes care of any arguments of people who won't listen to this type of thing because they say it's all emotional claptrap and this sort of thing. Computers and Automation, I don't know if you're familiar with the magazine, but it does not deal in emotionalism.
It publishes every month an issue on the assassinations, and it has listed now like five lawsuits pending related to access to information on the political assassinations. It gives the entire lawsuit it will publish, and photographic evidence of other cameras over Dealey Plaza. It's a very statistical magazine. It sticks with the facts, with the statistics, and lets the people see what's happening in the country. I asked Thunderbird Bookstore to carry Harold Weisberg's book, Frame Up, that we're going to discuss. It's the book on James Ray. It's an excellent book. Harold Weisberg wrote four books on the John Kennedy assassination, heavily documented. He's a thorough researcher, used to work for the FBI. But the Thunderbird says to me, well, it's a small publisher, so we won't carry those offbeat publishers. But
the big publishers won't carry stuff like this.
You went to 28 publishers, and they won't carry it. So you get one who has the courage. It's like saying that Mae Brussel's facts aren't true because she's on a small FM station that only reaches X amount of people in a radius so far, that her material can't be true. I could say what I'm saying in New York City, and it would be true. Or David Frost wouldn't let me on the show, you know, to discuss political assassinations. The national news media won't touch it at all. That doesn't mean it's not true. It means that they won't touch it.
Well, that's because too many of the people who have the final say in the upper echelons may have reasons for not wanting you to talk about it.
Yet in the establishment news, I mean, there's nothing more establishment than the New York Times edition of the 1970 Almanac. So I'm going to read to you what they say about James Ray and conspiracy out of that. You see, this is interesting what the New York Times has to say about James Ray, and yet if I wanted to go on a national program on a larger area and talk about it, they won't let you. So there's a section on page 591 in the Almanac called The Assassins, and it says, in quote, from the dark cellar of the American house, a rare creature has crawled out during the 1960s. He's a strange new strain of assassin, a killer, who's neither demented nor the spokesman for some cause. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, and James Earl Ray, brothers in death-making, were loners and losers in life, and these seemingly unmotivated killers do not fit the American dream of life as advertised by the Legionnaires, the Elks, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Birchers, and so on down. Assassination breeds new lowlife. Politics moves in with its own momentum. And even nothing stops, even the morbidity. No Warren Commission, no trials, without the true punishment of disclosure. The assassination American style is flat, vulgar, and meaningless. End quote for one moment. If these conspiracies are done by agencies within the United States, they are flat and vulgar and meaningless. You see, the men were not motivated. These individual men, or Charlie Manson, for any particular thing that would be associated with the reasons the victims were killed. And the Almanac is telling you that they were just flat, ugly, new type of American politics, which they were. Now, it goes back to say, in quotes, this horrible decade of assassination has become the decade of doubt, fantasy, suspicion, because the fallen idols were all honorable men, and as a result, the politics of conspiracy has moved to the forefront in many minds. There is no justice or sober justice. Were the killers fascists or communists, right or left wing, the CIA, the FBI, ask these questions. Oswald was killed by a friend of the Texas police. Sirhan changed his story constantly with the help of his lawyers. Ray strung out his story like a cat with a ball of wool, eventually entangling himself as well as the courts. The Warren Commission report, which was widely interpreted as a rush job, only served to proliferate new political speculation because the Johnson administration had lost its credibility following news management policies. And as for Sirhan and the Ray trials, justice became tongue-tied, even though both were convicted killers and confessed. Ray's punishment without trial, subject to examination of evidence or cross-examination and the accused appearance in the open court, disappointed the black community, and of all the three, the King case seemed to be the one in which there might well have been a conspiracy, or at least a clear racist involvement. Yet there was a prearranged deal between the prosecution and the admitted killer's attorney, Judge Battle, leaving the loose ends untied, and they went along with the deal, treating the assassination of Dr. King as though it were a routine murder case. With a sold Sirhan TV interview, the rights to Ray's story were peddled to the magazine. The first full account will eventually emerge, not in the courtroom, but by freelance justice in the slick magazines. Publicity, profit, and politics moved into the vacuum left by the justice denied American people. End quote. That's the New York Times almanac on assassinations.
Well, now, what about your own research into James Earl Ray and your own documentation? As I understand, today you're going to give us pretty much a chronology of James Earl Ray from beginning up to the time of imprisonment.
That's right. And I'll give you the name of three publications to read in case in this hour we can't really cover the whole of James Earl Ray. And if you're serious about studying political assassinations, get Harold Weisberg, the book called Frame Up, published by Outer Bridge and Dienstfree. The second book is John Siegenthaler, called A Search for Justice. That is the trial of Sirhan and Ray and Clay Shaw. Both of those books came out this last year. And then Computer and Automation, December 1970. Fort Ord Library and the Monterey Peninsula College have all of the issues, and you can photograph the legal documents on James Earl Ray his wanting a new trial, why there was evidence of conspiracy, what a trial would show, what deals were made to not let him have a trial. That is Computer and Automation, December 1970. Now, in A Search for Justice, the author begins by saying, Ray was arrested June 8, 1968. Martin Luther King was killed in April 1968, April 4th, and thus began one of the most unsatisfactory and inconclusive criminal judicial proceedings in American history. The aliases James Earl Ray used were Raymond George Sneed, Eric Starvogault, John Willard, Harvey Lohmeyer, W.C. Heron, James O'Connor, Paul Bridgman, and James Walton. Now, of these, Bob, the Raymond George Sneed, Eric Starvogault, and Paul Bridgman, three other men were using those names, too. They were in the geographical vicinity of James Ray. They lived in Canada, just within a mile radius of his home, and Bridgman had been down in the South in the same vicinity that Ray had moved and worked, and Ray had a roommate in the cell whose name was Bridgman. There were two other men using these names simultaneously, that he was using the three other men using the aliases, Raymond George Sneed, Eric Starvogault, and Paul Bridgman. Now, the background of James Earl Ray is interesting because he was described as being a born loser. Now, this background I'm giving you is up to the time he kills Martin Luther King, because he makes a distinct change in personality.
Mm-hmm.
He was described as a hardened professional criminal and never successful in any of the jobs he did. He tried a lot of robberies, and he was always bungling what he did. He robbed a grocery store, and in the process, he fell from the getaway car. He stole a typewriter, and he dropped his bank book at the scene of the crime. He robbed in Chicago, and he ran into a dead-end alley, and he was shot in this dead-end alley. He jumped into an elevator in St. Louis while he was robbing, and he was getting away from the deputies, but he forgot to close the elevator door, and they had grabbed his coat and caught him. They weren't serious charges. He was never involved in any hard violence, or, you know, of killing anybody or hurting them. But it was all petty stuff, and he was never out of trouble from the time he was little.
And he always arranged to get caught. It seems like that is a real portrait of a loser if I ever saw
one. He was always caught. He was in and out and in and out, and described as a born loser. His parents were very, very poor. He was a child of the Depression years, squalid poverty of Missouri. He was sickly when he was young, and he was branded a thief in school. They couldn't keep him from stealing while he was attending school. He was unfit for military service. He was a petty criminal, and he was turned down for military service. And he spent most of his adult life in prison. When he would get out, he'd steal. He was put back in, and he kept this cycle going all the time. Now, he escaped from the Missouri State Prison in the spring of 1967, and nobody bothered to look for him.
How did a guy like that manage to escape from prison? I would think the warden would have to come down and show him where the door was and help him out.
There was a drawing that he went through the bakery and out through a back door. And he didn't walk out the front door, but he went through the bakery through some kind of a tunnel, and he did escape. But they didn't look for him for 24 hours. The warden placed no search for him. He wasn't aware that he was missing, evidently. He was not conspicuous at the dinner table when they passed out the food, or when they locked up the cells, or
nobody looked around and said, "Hey, where's Jimmy?"
Huh? No, they didn't look for him. Now, it's a common fact, or it's common knowledge to me since I've been heavy into my research, and it wasn't before. And maybe I assume that my listeners know some of the things I take for granted. Maybe they're not familiar with the fact that police departments do hire convicts to commit certain crimes, or not the police department, persons who want crimes committed recruit. They have to work with the warden or somebody to get a man out of jail, and then he is hired to do another crime. The man who killed Jablonski said that he was hired while he was still in jail. And two men that were mentioned as suspects to kill Cesar Chavez are involved in being in jail, and they're protected in jail.
We don't know that they're in jail because the authorities won't tell us who they are.
That's right. But in my filing cabinet, where I have 1,800 or more different subjects that I cross-file, one of them is people hired in prison to go out and do a job, and provocateurs and hired by the FBI or the police or private persons, and they have to work some deal out with a warden. Charlie Manson was in jail on a 10-year rap, and After 6 years, he was given parole after he was carefully coached and trained, and then with $30 or so, he headed north. He was down near San Diego, and he headed north and met a girl who was a college graduate librarian, and he was on his way to spending a lot of money traveling and moving around. But he was carefully coached in jail, and then allowed out.
And specifically, didn't James Earl Ray's cellmate make some reference to the word was out that if anybody wanted to make a cool million,
you could involve killing King. That's right.
Cool million was offered for killing Martin Luther King at the time James Earl Ray was in prison.
Well, James Earl Ray was in prison.
Which may be coincidental, but I think it's
too far-fetched. Because while he was in prison, the conversation was killing Martin Luther King, and that they were floating the idea around among these prisoners that $1 million was available. And when James Ray was arrested in London and brought home, then a cellmate told the media, oh, I remember Ray, and isn't it a coincidence that the conversation was going?
He's escaped from the Missouri State Prison.
That's right. And nobody has called an alert. And at the time of his arrest for being a suspect in killing Martin Luther King, it seemed that there was no record out for a year and a half on looking for James Ray.
The FBI had no missing felon report.
There was no report around.
There was no record of his having escaped.
No record, and he had crossed borders from Mexico and Canada and back and forth into international boundaries. But the convict, known as James Earl Ray, was not, no one was conscious of looking for this particular person or these fingerprints or that face. The warden didn't call. And then James found a trailer after he escaped from the penitentiary where the door was open and there was wine, and he rested. It was raining, and he was safe and cozy.
A trailer just happened to be there, unlocked, and with a nice feast and wine and maybe a shower and change of clothes.
That's right. And the day before
he's lucky.
The day before he, in quotes, escaped, his brother visited him. His brother works for Mr. Stoner of the State's Rights Party, who says, I'm glad that King is dead, and I'll read you some of his language, how he describes.
Well, now, when all this was uncovered, didn't the prosecution make any effort to find out, for instance, who owned that trailer and who left it there available for James Earl Ray, and why it was unlocked and why it was so handy?
We're talking about something that was very logical to do if you want to find out who is after James Earl Ray.
But the question never came up, really.
Yeah. Now, Wes Graff of the FBI, in charge of the whole West Coast Division and all of the Los Angeles area, was up in Carmel at an FBI convention, the Holiday Inn, in 1968. And it was right after Martin Luther King was killed. And we had dinner together at Rocky Point. And he's a friend of my ex-husband's. They grew up, went to school together in South Dakota. And Wes Graff was up here with his wife. We went out for dinner. And I said, you could find the man who killed Martin Luther King if you wanted to, and I'll tell you how you could do it. And I began to list the ways you would go about if you wanted to catch him. But the FBI did not find Martin Luther King. Scotland Yard did. They said they spent almost a million. James Earl Ray. They said they spent almost $1 million in the investigation. I believe that, but it was misdirected. And it was Scotland Yard that found James Earl Ray. But I felt that it would have been very easy to find this particular person if they had really wanted, based upon my past research of the movements of Oswald.
Okay. He's now, out of prison. He's found his trailer. He's nice and rested now. He's had a little wine.
Yeah. Okay. His brother visits him. He's on his way. So April 22nd, his brother visits him. April 22nd, 1967. And April 23rd, he leaves the jail. And he goes to Kansas City with a Social Security card in his pocket. Number 318-24-7098. The name of the Social Security card is John Larry Raines. Now, it isn't ever mentioned that somebody in jail had that name and that he stole his Social Security card and used the alias. He had provided in his pocket an alias and a Social Security card, which is a legal government document hard to duplicate while you're sitting in the penitentiary all your life. It'd be hard to print those. But he has that, and he goes to a restaurant where he's a dishwasher at $107 a week, and he works there from April until July, July 16th.
April until July, April,
May, June,
July,
July. 4 months, a little less than 4 months, about 3 months. He's a dishwasher.
So he probably made a total of around $1,500, we'll say $1,500 to give us a round figure to work with.
Well, yeah, $400 a month. And his brother is about 10 miles from that restaurant, and his sister, and he does receive calls there and visitors while at work. He has made friends. He buys a car, and he buys a car.
Now, wait a minute. At $400 a month, you don't really save an awful lot of money
if you're
eating and paying rent.
Well, the buying, I guess you could buy a used car for $50, $100. That isn't hard on your first paycheck. It's a question of when you sign the names and everything, verification of the ownership. You see, he's an ex-convict who's out, and he's escaped from a jail.
Mm-hmm.
And the legal, just signing these names and buying these things, that it isn't the one thing he buys, but he continuously is doing transactions and getting passports and Social Security cards. And it seems to me that when you add up the sum total of how many times he's wide open for the public, you'd think that somebody would be looking for
him. Well, anyway, he had to make some kind of down payment on the car.
He bought a car, a Chrysler, and then he sold that and bought a Plymouth. And then in July, that's 4 months later, he goes into Canada under the name of Eric Starvo Gault. This is another alias he's to use. And he pays $175 advance and rents an apartment for 6 months. And then he goes to the tailor, and he's going to get some fancy clothes for around $200 an outfit because he's about to go to a nice resort hotel.
Now, where is he working now? Where is he getting this money?
Well, he goes to the Neptune Bar where he meets a named Raoul, R-A-O-U-L. And this name runs through his story all the time. And Raoul meets him later on Canal Street at the same location where Lee Harvey Oswald came and went. And this is James Ray's account for his money was smuggling dope and drugs for Raoul. He says that's how he got his up to $50,000.
He was dealing, huh?
He was dealing, yeah. But it's interesting, the story is that he's moving all this time from 1967, April, until 1968 at the time of the murder of Martin Luther King. And Raoul helps him buy a gun, and helps him buy a car, we'll go into. But when he goes to Memphis, he's never been in the city before in his life, and he goes to this particular hotel where Martin Luther King is being back-alleyed from him. He's never been in the city before in his life, and he has all his equipment and money, you know, binoculars and gun, and he chooses this particular motel. And then he makes a quick getaway against all the people that are surrounding it, and all the police. His excuse, I'm jumping around here a little, but I don't want to forget it. When he left the Lorraine Motel, the rooming house that he had in back of the Lorraine Motel, he left the gun that allegedly shot Martin Luther King, and he left a bag with toilet articles, newspaper, and beer cans, and his radio that he'd had with him ever since his prison days. And the question was said, why did you drop all that stuff and leave that, fingerprints and everything, all this evidence of who you are, you know? And his answer was, well, the policemen were at the restaurant across the street by the Lorraine Motel, and they would be outside if they saw him leaving with these packages, that he'd be a suspect. Now, a gun's gone off, and Martin Luther King is killed, and it's surrounded by policemen eating in the restaurants around there. And he doesn't want to be seen with all these things. Well, they don't grab him leaving the building that's behind the Lorraine Motel. They let him run, whether he had anything in his hand or not. If he didn't have a gun in his hand, they didn't stop him. You would think if the policemen are going to see anyone come out of that building, and Martin Luther King's been killed out in that balcony, you can imagine the noise and the excitement that those policemen would be running out from this restaurant. So there were a lot of policemen right at that building.
Now he's had the dishwashing job at $400 a month for 3 months, a little over 3 months.
He's been in jail all of his life.
Bought a car, sold that, bought another car, traveled to Canada, and in Montreal he meets a man named Raoul, R-A-O-U-L.
Yes, and then he goes to a resort hotel, and he dates a woman. He stays there for 7 days where he's wearing his new clothes, and he's all prettied up. And goodness knows what kind of grammar or manners, you know, after his impoverished childhood, you know, in Missouri. He's swinging it at a Canadian resort, and he is dating and living with, for that 1 week, sleeping with this particular woman who's the secretary to the Canadian Federal Department of Transportation, which is a government, Canadian government kind of job in the Federal Department of Transportation. And she finds him perfectly charming. They dine and dance, and Ray has become a charmer.
Okay, now let's halt at that point while I say you're listening to Dialogue Assassination with Mae Brussel on KLRB Carmel.